Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Good morning, and welcome to the Parenting Aces radio show on Blog Talk Radio's UR Tennis Network. I'm your host, Lisa Stone, and it is early here in Atlanta. We are pre-recording today's show with our fabulous guest, Steve Smith. Due to a couple different reasons. One, I am getting ready to hit the road and head down to Mobile, Alabama for our Southern Closed with my son. And two, because Steve is so busy on the court that it was going to be really difficult for either of us to be on the air live with you on Monday afternoon. So we are pre-recording on this Friday the 13th. It has already proven to be kind of a challenging Friday the 13th as we've tried to connect this morning, but I now have Steve on the line, so I'm going to go ahead and bring him on. Steve, are you with us?
Lisa, I'm here.
Oh, yay. It's been a little tricky this morning, but thank you so much for being here so early. I don't know about you, but I'm on my second cup of coffee and ready to go.
Oh, you're more than welcome. I look forward to talking to you.
Great. Well, I wanted to give our listeners a little bit of background on your history in the sport. My interaction with you has been very recent. The first time I ever came across you was actually on another tennis parent website, and Nicole had done an interview with you a few years back that I read, and as I was reading it, thought, oh my gosh, I've got to meet this guy. He sounds amazing. I want him to work with my child. And Nicole and I spoke after that, and she told me that you had, in fact, trained her husband to coach, and they've brought their daughter down from Canada to work with you periodically over the years. So maybe you can give the listeners a little bit more background than that on your history in tennis and how you came to be the phenomenal junior development coach you are today.
Well, thanks for saying that. But Mom, I'm going to be 60 years old this year, so I've been in tennis 40 years. I started off as a volunteer. I'm really a product of the tiebreaker. You know, when I was a kid, everyone played three sports. And when I was at a prep school in New Hampshire, and had senioritis, and when it came down, they reinstated the rule where you had to play a third sport in the spring. So I was a hockey player, and I played tennis, and I fell in love with tennis. James Van Allen had invented the tiebreaker. Tennis was put on TV, and as everyone knows now, tennis exploded in the 70s. And I wanted to make my living in sport, but at that time, pretty much, someone would get a PE degree, physical education degree, and coach in the afternoon. What I did was I withdrew from school. I later went back to school. But really on my own accord, I went on a venture to learn how to teach tennis. And I was told first what I needed to do is learn how to play tennis. So I was just shy of the age of 20. And I mean, if I was an athlete, I mean, I played NCAA hockey and played sports growing up. But I put all my energy into tennis, and the first chapter really was learning how to play. But I didn't really learn to play through osmosis. I didn't learn to play as a 9-year-old. I was 19 years old, and you know, teaching is information transfer, and I found out very quickly that there really wasn't that much information in the, you know, the more I read and the more I listened and the more I traveled, the more I was exposed to tennis. I started studying tennis under tennis masters and tried to study methodology. So that was really one chapter. I did a lot of internships. I was kind of a tennis camp junkie. Worked at various tennis camps. I even at one point lived in a van playing tournaments. I did that for 1 year. And then the second year, I just traveled around the United States going to different tennis camps. I met Dr. Eugene Allen years ago in Tyler, Texas, and I was 26, and he had set up a program for dental hygienists. He was a dentist, and he allowed me to revise an academic curriculum, and that's where I taught Frank Hornig, Lauren's wife, and I put together a curriculum where he did a 2-year degree. It was the first of its type in the United States or perhaps the world, and I had a great deal of time. I was there almost 10 years. Actually, I was in Tyler, Texas 10 years. And what we did is we brought in one speaker every semester. I think the teacher always learns more than the student. But the philosophy was to try to expose the 2-year tennis teaching student to as many different methodologies as possible. And then from there, I entered the business world. I worked for Tennis Corporation of America. Actually, prior to that, I worked for Seguso Bassett, which is now Chris Evert. I was very idealistic that I could make the tennis academy legit, could make it honest. And because I had a great deal of success in Tyler, Texas with juniors, the second 5 years I was there, in this small town, small city, 70,000 people, we developed more state champions in Dallas and Houston combined. So I went back to Boca. That's where I first started off as a tennis bum at the age of 19. I went back to Boca Raton. And it was at Seguso Bassett's. And then from there, I was there. I was short. I was there 2 years. I went to work for Tennis Corporation for 2 years. They hired me to train tennis teachers. They, at that time, had 50-plus clubs. But, you know, when you sit at a table, can you be at a table where, you know, people all are on the same agenda, they all have the same motives? But from that point, I started my own business, Tennis Smith. And I guess that would be a quick summary of 40 years in tennis.
That's an amazing summary of 40 years in tennis. It just goes to this whole idea that great tennis coaches are born out of great tennis coaching relationships and mentors, and it sounds like you had the opportunity to take advantage of the coaching knowledge of so many great coaches over the years and incorporate that and mold that into your coaching philosophy. And if you wouldn't mind sharing, and you touched on Tennis Smith, and we're going to dig into that because I definitely want my listeners to know what that resource is, but can you share with us your philosophy of junior tennis development and coaching juniors as they come up?
Well, I spent so many years with Vic Braden. When Vic was asked about philosophy, he always said it's physics, it's not philosophy. You know, physics dictates what happens to a tennis ball. I think you have to really honor goals. I think the goal as the coach is to help the player reach their goals. But I think it has to be fact-based instruction with long-term development. When it comes down to, you know, if a kid looks you in the eye or they sign on a goal sheet, you know, that they want to play college tennis, they want to play pro tennis, I think you really have to help them with their goals. But philosophically, you know, I think tennis is a vehicle, and you really have to try to teach character 101. And so it's more than just tennis skills. It's really teaching life skills.
Right, right. And you mentioned goals. I just read something recently written by another coach that said the goals are really important, but more important than the goals or in conjunction with the goals, you have to have systems in place to attain the goals, and that it's all well and good for somebody to say, I want to play college tennis or I want to play professional tennis, but if there are no systems in place to help reach that goal, then the goal is really useless. Do you feel the same way about that?
Well, one comment on goals is I would say a vast majority of young tennis players, they need to take their goals and throw them out the window because it really makes them in the end, it makes them choke, it makes them very nervous. When it comes down to a goal of simply having fun, you know, I want to be the best I can be. I mean, to play D3 tennis is a great achievement. And you know, I think a lot of tennis players are stuck out in Division I. I think when it comes down to goals, anything that can be measured can be improved. So you definitely want to have systems in place. And I think that's one of the biggest problems in tennis teaching is anything goes. 2 + 2 = 5 in the tennis teaching world. I mean, water runs uphill in the tennis teaching world.
Right. And what do you think that is? Why do you think that is? That we've become, you know, just this society of tennis instruction that really a lot of the times makes no sense.
Well, I think the customer's always right. I think it's killing kids with kindness. It's, you know, it's too much about money. You know, years ago, it was very much like piano. Tennis, you would take your one lesson a week, and you would skip rope and hit the backboard and play mini tennis. You'd call people up, and, you know, you would hang around, and young junior players would play with adults. So when it comes down to many, many things come into that answer with, you know, why is it that way? With if you watch someone swim, you know, may not know anything about swimming, but you know the person can't swim. You know, in the sport I grew up in, if you're watching someone skate and they can't skate, you know that. Even if you've never, you know, they're falling down, you could just tell. But with tennis, this word style, you know, the human eye doesn't record fast enough, and we feel like everyone has a different style and anything goes. And there is always that exception to the rule where someone perhaps has a very inefficient, unorthodox forehand or backhand, and just through their mental toughness, through their willpower, you know, they find a way, just despite a technical weakness, to become a very, very good tennis player. Generally, that hole will stop them like a brick wall when they get to a certain level. But no, I think style. I think anything goes. And I think another thing, too, is it's so easy to be a tennis teacher. You know, I'm a member of the PTR and the USPTA. I have been a member for over 30 years and tested with both organizations. And I promote both organizations. I think that you have to be associated if you're going to become a tennis teaching professional. But you really can't be, you know, you can't compare certification to education. You can't really do something for 2 days and say, okay, I'm ready to go.
Right.
Many, many different reasons why tennis is that way. The human eye, when you watch tennis on TV, the TV's so small. The TV's about the size of 2 rackets. The player's about the size of your finger. The ball's about the size of the fingernail. The camera's shooting from down. So it's a three-dimensional sport shown on a two-dimensional plane, and it's very distorted. And then the opinions just roll out. and
yeah.
If you Google modern forehand, you'll get over 1,000 choices. You Google modern backhand, you'll get a dozen. And most tennis arguments don't get past the forehand today. You know, Braden's theme: the dimensions of the court and physical laws dictate stroke production. No coach's opinion or any unique theory. And you know, now with the internet, it's as if there's more bad information going out faster, so the problems are worse. They're worse than they've ever been.
Interesting. Well, so that provides a really good segue, your mention of the Internet. You have become part of the internet generation by establishing a website. That's www.tennissmith.com. It's TENNISSMITH.com. And you have a pretty big presence on Facebook and on Twitter. You're very actively sharing your knowledge with the world at large, whoever chooses to take advantage of it, and I'm one of those. I take advantage of your shares all the time and repost your articles, retweet your tweets, and I, for one, am very grateful for the fact that you have chosen to use the internet to share your experience and knowledge with the rest of us. Can you talk a little bit about how your web presence, both on your website and social media, has impacted your day-to-day teaching and how you assimilate and share information?
Well, Lisa, I appreciate saying that we have a presence. I would say it's very, very small. We have a course called Tennis Intelligence Applied. It's a 25-hour course. And there's 365 plus clips, short video clips. And, you know, people are busy, and we found out, and I don't want to be doom and gloom or pessimistic, but a lot of times when someone takes a course, they take it for college credit. They're not taking it just to learn. So with the course, I thought, okay, 25 hours, because I travel and I do educational workshops, I said, okay, let me make a course that's about 25 hours long. And from that, we branched off, and we have a one-hour course called the Great Base Initiative. And we've recently put together, it's a spinoff from a teaching aid in the 80s, the Great Base Backboard. So, and then every day for over 3 years, we've been putting something up on Facebook. I think just recently, Andrew Garcia helps me out, has started to put things on Twitter. But I'm pretty much a zero when it comes down to, you know, being a computer techie, but I would like to think that we're a drop of tennis intelligence fighting the ocean of tennis ignorance. and I hate to again be doom and gloom, but it's really sad. You know, my father was an engineer, but he coached hockey as a volunteer for decades, and it's very frustrating to know that young kids get such a poor start in tennis. I'll tell you, this is a shocker. This is a published article I wrote. It was almost 2 years ago, National 12s. You know, incognito, we filmed from behind 50 boys, 50 girls. We filmed their serves. And over 90% of the kids filmed had some version of palm up on their serve, and they had some version of having a Western grip, and it was not just the grip, it was the wrist position and the elbow down and the upper arm almost glued to the upper body. I think we're perhaps a few snowflakes, maybe becoming a snowball. I mean, I don't think that we're an avalanche or we ever will, but we're trying to reach people through the internet.
Well, I think your reach may be bigger than you know, because whenever I share your information, it always garners comments, likes, reposts, all of that, and I think people are really paying attention to the information you put out there. And one of the things in particular that I think is so interesting, and it's something, a question I've been asking for a while, I grew up playing junior tennis, but I wasn't very good and never had any aspirations to play even in college. So, I mean, that tells you the level I was at and my commitment level. But the question I've been asking for a while is, why are there no backboards anymore? My son has had the opportunity to train at, you know, several pretty nice clubs around Atlanta, but also as we've traveled, he's gone to places where there's no wall to hit against. And I grew up that's what you did. You hit against the wall to warm up. You hit against the wall when there was nobody to play with or while you were waiting for your opponent to show up. And now those walls seem to have just gone by the wayside. You are trying to reintroduce the concept of using a backboard. And there's also another organization called Project Backboard that's trying to get backboards back into tennis facilities and public facilities and all of that. Why is the backboard so important? Why do we need to get back to that?
Well, one, there's no backboards because backboards don't make money. Coming back to the previous question, when kids used to take private lessons, they would pay their fee. But many times in a program, and I think kids get programmed out, where they will, the parent, the consumer, they write the check, and it's a large check, but it's not as much per hour as a private lesson. And then the pro makes more money, the child's on the court more hours, but a lot of times they're empty hours. When it comes down to a backboard, also to it's not just they don't make money. People are not charged to hit on a backboard at a club. But also to kids now, certainly, you got to put the cell phone away and go to work. 15 minutes on a backboard is equivalent to an hour of balls hit. You read about champions, whether it was Borg, whether it was Federer, they're really products of the backboard. Selish, she was in a situation where growing up where 12-year-olds couldn't be on the court till you're 12 years old. So she, hit and hit and hit against the backboard. I think Daniel Coyle's book, Talent Code, I think most tennis coaches are in tune with that now, where the brain produces myelin, and you need quality of movement, but quantity wins. Hungry dog eats best, or also hungry, I can't even think of that, I say it every day, hungry dog hunts best.
Right.
And, we entertain kids too many times instead of educate kids. When it comes down to the parent, understandably, they today overprotect their child. You can't just let your child get on the bike and ride to the park, and you can't just go hang out at the tennis club. So many times, again, being programmed out, kid has a training session from 9 to 11. They get there at 9, they leave at 11. It's not getting there early, hitting the backboard, staying late, hitting the backboard, hitting the backboard, waiting for someone to show up so you can, find a practice set.
Right. And so what are you doing differently? I know you, have you moved already, or are you getting ready to move?
No, I've moved. I still have property in Tampa, Florida. I still have a setup where we're producing backboards, and we're still helping some students shift to work with other coaches. There's five or six coaches at other facilities that I've trained in Tampa. But no, I'm in Raleigh. I'm talking to you from Cary, North Carolina. I'm going to be based out of North Carolina State.
And are you've started coaching in that area now?
Yeah, I've been here for a week.
Okay, awesome. So what are you doing differently than you see your peers doing out there?
Well, I think many times tennis teaching becomes more service-oriented than education-oriented. I think that, I'm not microwaving tennis. There's no instant gratification. It's not a matter of, we have to be ready to play. The game-based teaching, I think there's a lot of positives to game-based teaching, but I think the number one reason for game-based teaching is to make it fun, have the kid come back, and it becomes business-oriented. But form-based teaching is pretty much gone out the window. But I think if you can combine form-based teaching with game-based teaching, call it principle-based teaching. I would say for the most part, people are not teaching a technical base, a great base, where at the end of, say, someone starts playing tennis at age 8, 10 years later, they're going to be able to serve, they're going to be able to volley, they're going to be able to play true doubles where they serve and come to the net. Some of the lost arts in tennis, and it's unfortunate that you know, the approach volley and then the approach shot. So I say that, you know, teaching skills, teaching hard skills, that's one thing that's not being done for the most part.
Well, some would argue that the game's changed, and so there's really no need to teach those types of shots that you're talking about, because that's not how the game is played anymore. So what's your response to that when you watch the pro level?
Well, I think that's one of the problems, too, is that we do turn the TV on, and at the end of the rainbow is the pro level. And I think it's really absurd, you know, in a 10 or 11-year-old is going, yeah, coach, but, you know, watch what Nadal's doing. And, yeah, well, let's watch what Nadal's doing. Let's watch the angle of the racket head, watch, you know, how he goes high, low, high, inside, out, watch how he closes in. You know, let's watch what Nadal's doing. And, you know, Nadal, like Borg, was very, very misinterpreted on what he actually does to strike a tennis ball. When it comes down to the game has evolved, but the game really hasn't changed. You know, I like to go with tennis history, and I think if you're really going to know a subject, you need to know the history of it. You know, Rosewall, you know, he got to the Wimbledon final in 1954. He played Connors in 74. That's 20 years. So Connor goes almost another 20 years. And he's knocking on the door to be in the U.S. Open final. Not quite 20 years, but 91, when he had his great run, played Courier. So that's two players almost 40 years. And, you know, you could throw Agassi into that and, okay, let's extend it now to it's over 50 years. And, you know, players staying close to the baseline, having short, compact swings. When it really comes right down to that's a major, major problem, major myth that, you know, sure enough, it, you know, the Division I level, or you watch players play at futures level, but if you look at the very, very fast players, you know, you look at a Djokovic's backhand, or it's better yet, just Federer. He's the model for the Spanish system. When it comes down to commentators on TV, it's more small talk than it is fact-finding talk. And, you know, no one really talks about, you know, the nuts and bolts of how Roger Federer hits a tennis ball. People know that he is very efficient, he's very smooth, he's elegant, whatever the word may be. But, you know, I think that's really a cop-out. And I sum that up by crummy plays crummier. Two kids travel a long ways to play a tournament. And, you know, it's not very nice to refer to a kid as crummy, but, you know, I think parents should know how college coaches are talking to each other. You know, they're scouting. They're saying, okay, who am I going to give a four-year scholarship to? And that's one of the reasons that we don't have enough American kids playing college tennis is it's crummy versus crummier. Winning's confusing. So, I try to get people's attention. It's clones taught by clowns. I mean, if, you know, a kid can't take a ball out of the air, kid can't go to the net, their technique really reduces their tactical options. Mm-hmm. But people don't go to the net because they don't go to the net. And if a kid plays one-up, one-back doubles as a freshman in high school because they have a better chance of winning, that's what they're going to do as a sophomore. You know, at the National 12 they referred to, we charted 1,000 points. It's not the most exciting thing to do, but we only recorded 7 overheads in 1,000 points.
Wow.
I don't think we're being clever enough. It's like with the quick start, the 10 and under initiative. Wouldn't it have been smart if we said, okay, all these 10-year-olds are going to play with a transition ball, but they have to play one-bounce doubles. The ball bounces twice, they lose the point. Then the rule would force the kid.
Explain what that means. Explain what that means, one bounce doubles.
One bounce doubles, so the ball only has to bounce once in doubles. And if you watch the Bryan brothers play, it's only bouncing once. I mean, they're going to serve, the ball's going to bounce, and then they're at the net. So
gotcha.
You could take that right down to the 8-year-olds, and I love to read what Wayne Bryan has to say about tennis. But when it comes down to, okay, we're going to play one-bounce doubles. We're going to serve. We're going to get in. I think with Quick Start Tennis, if the USTA had form tournaments, so you have to get posters of the best players in the world at the impact point. Instead of having them misinterpret what they're watching on TV, watch the players off a poster and say, okay, at the beginning of our little kid, early child development, quick start class, we're going to have a form tournament. Whoever shows these body positions, racket positions the best is going to win the prize. But the problem we have is the prize is winning. And, you know, parents are climbing the fence, they're biting their fingernails. And understandably, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. There's a lot of money that's being spent, and it's their child. And I think that's one reason that parents, you know, they get on the merry-go-round and they go from one coach to the next, you know, trying to look for improvement. But I think a lot of times when they go from one coach to the next, they don't really find someone who's going to say, okay, we need to take 10 steps backwards, take 20 steps ahead. We don't need to worry about ranking. And, you know, where are you going to be when you're, you know, 22 years old? Are you going to still be playing the great game of tennis? But too many people leave tennis, and they leave tennis. It's not really burnout. It's a frustration factor. They're practicing hour after hour, and they're not getting better because they have the same inefficient movements.
Right. And, I mean, I see this all the time, you know, in my son's peer group where – these kids that were winning in the 12s and 14s, you know, winning handily, by the time they're in the 16s and the 18s, the other kids have caught up. These kids that were winning young maybe didn't develop the incentive or the drive to work hard to keep that same margin between themselves and the ones behind them. And all of a sudden, they're getting beaten by the kids that they were crushing in the 12s and 14s, and they throw their hands up and quit. And we see that a lot. Now that my son's, you know, entering his last year in junior tennis, he'll be 18 next month, you know, we're even seeing his peers choosing not to play college tennis after having gone through all these years of junior tennis.
Patrick Gibson is a great young American player. I said to his father last week, I said at lunch, I said, you know, tennis heats people up and spits them out. And he said, so is life. And that's where people need to hang in, and it's a matter of competing. It's not a matter of winning and losing. But, you know, as a tennis parent, I'm a tennis parent. I have two boys who play in my, or perhaps I should past tense, my oldest son. You know, he'll go knock some balls around, but, you know, he doesn't play, and just based on his wins, he was one of the best players in the country as a little kid, you know, 10s and 12s. But he never learned to lose. But no, winning for a young kid definitely is a curse. I mean, there's, you know, people like Roddick, for example, who he won in the 12s, and he kept taking it further and further. But no, it's true. They typically become one-dimensional defensive specialists, and there's many young players that, you know, they'll play five or six at a major university, and, you know, they don't play doubles because they ended up being a counterattacker. And, you know, that's one aspect of tennis is, you know, when you go to the net, you go to the net to lose at a faster rate. Because when you're, you know, 4 feet tall, you're going to go to the net and you're going to get lobbed.
Right.
And, you know, that's one thing that's gone away from tennis, Lisa, is the junior versus veteran match at a club where, you know, you have the seniors playing with the young tennis players. But, no, when you go to the net, it's confusing. You win 2 out of 3, that turns into 4 out of 6, 8 out of 12. But once, you know, so you're at a 66% rate of effectiveness at the net, which is actually phenomenal. If you put that together consecutively, you'd win 6-0, 6-0. But the young kid who becomes a human backboard, they can arc the ball, they can push the ball all day long, they usually cheat more than anyone else, is they're trying to win 100% of the points. And they're not taking any risks. So they get stuck. And again, Milan, they're conditioned to only play the one-dimensional game. So, you know, that's unfortunate. And there's not enough emphasis on doubles. You know, we're, but again, when kids do finally get around to play doubles, and, you know, the racket comes into it, is, you know, Pete Sampras was asked, if your son Christian were to play tennis, what would your advice be? He said, have him learn to play with a wooden racket. You know, a 10 and under tennis player doesn't need to have a super duper racket. It would be great if they had a racket that would force them to not try to be so offensive and be more skilled.
Right, and that's, I guess, the purpose of the red, orange, green 10 and under tennis, which, you know, I mean, in my uneducated opinion, I think it's a great way to introduce the game to kids, but to lock kids into that until they're out of the 10s and now they're using green balls into the 12s, to me, limiting it by age does a huge disservice to the kids who are ready to move on.
Well, Wayne Bryant's right. I mean, if it was 6 and under tennis versus 10 and under tennis, the different balls, the transition balls, it's a great training tool. I mean, I remember years ago where we would put tennis balls in water, and then we would brush the ball. We would do many, many things to try to have the ball be slower, just using dead tennis balls. But I think there's a lot of positives to the transition ball. I mean, the graduated length method, GLM, where you can shorten the court, shorten the racket, shorten the stroke. I mean, that's been around for a long time, but I think Quick Start, in many ways, is an insult to old coaches like myself and then coaches way before me. And I think there's a disconnect where I don't think people actually study what coaches that have gone before us have contributed to tennis. But why can't you play mini tennis and just tell the kids don't hit the ball hard?
Right.
So when it comes down to, I think many times it's organized babysitting, but the parent, the consumer, they don't have consumer knowledge. They don't have exposure. If they're only seeing the kids play at the tennis park, the tennis club they go to, last year I was in Europe, and I was at 14 and under European tournaments. And certainly, you know, the red clay is a great teacher. We've made some mistakes in American tennis where Kalamazoo used to be on red clay. Rod Laver won Kalamazoo, I think it was 59, and it was best of 5 sets. The Orange Bowl, they're going back to clay now, but it's coming back. It's just like the backboard, anything to keep more balls in play. And, you know, that is one thing about how the game has changed, where the kid can whack a winner. So if you have a kid who's born in January and they're playing against someone who's born in December, you know, Malcolm Gladwell's book, Outliers, I think it's the second chapter. So you get an 8-year-old who's had a growth spurt, and so he can whack the forehand, and, you know, he doesn't know that, unfortunately, what he thinks is a strength is his weakness. And, you know, then he goes 4 or 5 years, and then finally someone connects with the family and says, you know, that forehand is not an asset, it's a total liability. And that's all he's got. He pushes the serve in, keeps a couple balls in play, and then his forehand becomes home run derby. And, you know, he's going for the $100 shot from the 10-cent position. So now he's been playing, he started playing when he's 7, 8 years old, now he's 14, 15. You know, then he finds out that the light at the end of the tunnel is a train coming right at him.
Hmm.
Because, you know, he didn't learn refined skills. I mean, he or she, they didn't learn to play all over the court.
Interesting. So if you were speaking to a parent who comes up to you and says, I'm thinking about starting my child in tennis, I need to find a coach, I have no idea what to look for, what questions to ask, what would you tell that parent?
Well, I think the same common sense that apply to life. I think, like, say, Stephen Covey's book, The 7 Habits of Highly Successful People, begin with the end in mind. You know, be proactive. You know, I think we're, perhaps Jim Pierce, Mary Pierce's dad, you know, he was given the label tennis parent from hell, because Jim went a little bit too far. I think some parents go a little bit too far. You know, Bobby Knight, the great basketball coach, he went a little bit too far. I mean, I don't think you need to throw the chair. I don't think you need to hit the police officer. But so some parents, you know, they go a little bit too far. But when it comes down to be proactive, you know, when it comes down to another thing, Stephen Covey, sharpen the saw. Well, how's the basic forehand hit, and then realize there's stage development and there's no shortcut, there's no quick fix, and you're going to go out and you're going to toss balls to your child. You're going to practice together. You're going to hit the backboard. And you know, I think if someone said, okay, I'd like to play college tennis, and what a great way to stay with sport while you're continuing your education, and say, well, my child is 9 years old. They're halfway to the age of 18. And so I'm going to multiply 365 times 9. I'm going to get the number of days I have, and then I'm going to multiply that by 1440, the number of minutes I have per day. And then I'm going to try to go with quality and quantity. And, you know, so it's not bragging rights. It's not, you know, who wins 10 and unders. I always tease people, and I try to say things a certain way to get a certain knee-jerk reaction, because sometimes you just have to hit people over the head. The smartest person at a 10 and under tournament is the parent of the 10-year-old who wins. And if 64 10-year-olds play a tournament, who wins? One 10-year-old. But I think, you know, common sense, put things in perspective, and I think to ask a tennis parent, have you been down the road before? Is this your first child? Is this your first child who's played tennis? And so I think just to open one's eyes, and it's really skills. You know, confidence comes from winning, comes from skills, but skills come from practice and know-how. Well, give us the know-how, and then we got to go practice.
But, Steve, I think you'll agree that it's very easy for parents to be sold a bill of goods out there. And as you said at the beginning of the show, you know, there's a difference between having, you know, going through a two-day course and calling yourself a tennis teacher versus years of acquired knowledge and learning. And so for a parent that really doesn't know tennis, and like I said before, I grew up playing, but when it came time to choose a coach for my son, I didn't have a clue what to look for. I mean, I had one coach my whole childhood that was the coach at the neighborhood club, and that's where I played. So I didn't have any idea how to choose a coach or what questions to ask or what to look for. It's so easy for coaches to sell us being tennis parents, you know, on, well, I've developed this number of champions, you know, all my 10-year-olds are bringing home trophies every weekend, so that's why you want to send your child to me. How do we work through all the BS?
Yeah, Lisa, I think it's two-sided. I think, you know, unfortunately, tennis is a credibility business. Credibility means you're believable, but it doesn't mean you're truthful. And, you know, the parents many times are looking for a shortcut. I always tell people that a boxer has a sparring partner. The sparring partner wears a helmet, a mouth guard, and the sparring partner doesn't say anything. Well, in tennis, a lot of times the young player coming out of college, perhaps they didn't finish their degree, and they fall into tennis teaching because it's a lot better than minimum wage. And they can hit the ball, but then they're compelled to talk, and they've got nothing to say, and they're just totally winging it. So there's even a level below the people who are going to those certification courses, that the people, they're just going to start to teach and coach instantly overnight. Here recently, obviously, the credibility coached up at the top. You know, Connors with Roddick, and now Becker with Djokovic, Chang with Nishikori. I mean, I think they all have many things to offer. I think they're a mentor. I think they're a confidant. And I've been in those circles. There's not a lot of coaching going on. All you got to do is listen to commentators on TV. So it is a wow factor. It is America. I'm proud to be an American, but, you know, Taekwondo, take your dough. They used to have a black belt and a brown belt. Now they got every color in the rainbow because we want to feel good and we want to buy it. And when it comes down to the, I said the parent doesn't have consumer knowledge. The coach, for the most part, doesn't have product knowledge, but they know what they're selling, and they're selling the hustle, and that's what it is. It's a street hustle. They're gonna say, this is what I can do for you. And when parents go from one coach to the next, it's not like they go on a national search. They just got to go 5 miles down the road. And it's unfortunate, but really when it comes right down to the brass tacks of it is you need quality information and you need quantity, you need reps. And, you know, one bad coach is better than 10 different coaches, the way the brain works. But really, in the end, I think that's where, in our country, it's a very individualistic setting in the U.S. I mean, I think that's why it's appealing for so many people to live here. But I've spent a lot of time in socialistic countries, and it has, you know, nothing to do with political opinion, but we don't work together enough as a team. There's not a connection between the early childhood development class and then skill acquisition and then tournament prep. And it's unfortunate, you know, it's summertime in the U.S. now, and so many coaches, it's capitalistic, they're really a briefcase pro. They're not a ball hopper pro. And they're hiring young high school players, and the most inexperienced coaches are working with the young kids who need the most experienced coaches. You know, it's a lot easier to coach kids that are playing, you know, 18 and under sectional tennis than it is to go out and say, okay, I'm going to try to teach these six-year-olds how to hit a tennis ball.
Right.
But there's no substitute for a good beginning. You know, that comes back to my age. What I'd like to do is share what I've shared with people in our Great Base Initiative. That's what we need to do. We need to give kids a great base. It's just like learning math. You know, the battle hymn of the mother tiger, if the Chinese mom knew what I knew about tennis, they could go to town. Because what you need to do is you need to have the basics down and then practice. When it comes down to,
Are there any specific red flags that parents should be aware of when choosing a coach?
Oh, I mean, it comes down to most coaches can't recognize palm up from palm down on the serve. If they could, the kid wouldn't have a palm up serve. You know, most coaches, and again, I get people mad at me, but most coaches don't even know the grips. If you turn the racket 8 times, it goes 360 degrees. So if you change your base knuckle from one bevel to the next, 360 divided by 8 is 45. So, you know, I've worked with many, many great coaches. Welby Van Horn. You know, Welby said, if tennis teachers were doctors, people would be falling dead in the streets. I mean, you have to find a coach who, you know, realizes that, you know, the court is less than 20 degrees wide, and if your kid's got a swing that goes like a merry-go-round, the ball's going to rotate like a Frisbee. If your swing goes like a Ferris wheel, the ball rotates like a bicycle tire. And you can, you know, go watch two children play, and neither one of them can hit topspin. And that's one of the bad things about the orange ball, the red ball, is anything goes. You can have very poor technique and rally with an orange ball. So, you know, I think that the USTA and other organizations around the world, I mean, federations are there to help, and there's so many people that are dedicated to tennis and great people with the USTA. But who gets a tennis player down the road? Who has a better chance of developing a player, a family or a federation? And the answer is a family. So that's another whole can of worms is, you know, who should be doing the coaching. But it really needs to start, again, just like education in elementary school. It has to start with the beginning. So red flags, are they learning a technical base? And our sport is very, very difficult. The fastest-growing sport in America is lacrosse. You know, tennis, ball comes out of a ball machine at 30 miles an hour. You change the racket by 1 degree, the ball goes 6 feet further. And that's one reason of many that we lose players to other sports. But we have these young kids that are, you know, the coach wants them to be in the junior development program, you know, 5 days a week, and they're only 5, 6 years old. You know, come out every day. They would be better off like years ago, become an athlete in the early years playing a number of different sports, and but always be working on technique. You know, like John McEnroe played three sports in high school. You know, Andy Roddick and Marty Fish were on the same high school basketball team. A lot of parents don't know those type of things. And those, coming back to your question on bill of goods, that's, you know, people are sold more time as well. Yeah, come out, and this is what you got to do. And it makes sense, okay, we practice every day. But, you know, does a young kid know a fundamental foundation? Do they practice in front of a mirror in the morning? You know, you brush your teeth in the morning, you shadow swing in front of the mirror. Do they actually know a great base? And again, I'm not a salesperson. People know that. But, you know, do they hit a backboard? So it's not as if I'm trying to sell backboards, but wouldn't it be great if every kid knew the great base, their coach, their parent knew the great base? In American tennis, we're working together. Because I'm just like anyone else. I'm tired of reading the articles, you know, what's happened to American tennis.
Right.
But we need to become more of a sport, Lisa. It's too much of a business.
No, that's a very wise statement. And speaking of that, what do you make of all this talk that we need, we being U.S. tennis, need to be doing what they're doing in Spain? You know, if we did what they did in Spain, we would have champions. That's the problem. And so now there's go ahead.
You know, lucky for me is I've had a chance to travel quite a bit. I've taught tennis in over 30 countries, and I remember doing some work for the Irish tennis, and then I was over there years later. I'm divorced, but my former wife is Irish, and my sons were playing in the tournament, the Irish Open. But at that time, I had done my work with the Irish Federation, and then the coaches from Belgium were there because Clijsters and Hennen were doing so well. So because the Spaniards were doing so well as a group in men's tennis, but I've been through Emilio Sanchez's course. I loved it. You can always learn. Mark Twain, every time you meet someone, you meet your master. But, you know, it's an inside joke within the USTA that you have to teach Spanish to work for the USTA. And when it comes down to David Ferrer, he's the most popular player among the pros. He has very basic swings. He has a very basic tactical approach. But I don't think that that's the answer, that the Spanish system, if you actually but I do think, you know, when it comes down to the nuts and bolts of how they're teaching people how to hit the forehand, backhand, but I think one thing that is different in Spain versus the United States is if you're coaching young kids at a club, you respect it, and that I don't think really takes place. You know, we're a vast country, 3,000 miles wide, 300 million people. You know, my youngest son spent a lot of time in Sweden, for example. And, you know, Stefan Edberg's hanging out at practice. Magnus Larsson is on the staff. And there's only 10 million people. They live in the lower part of Sweden. So how kids are exposed to top players. But, no, when it comes down to the Spanish system, you know, with, you know, what is a Spanish system? It's basic. It's common sense. You know, you have to have efficient swings. You have to hit a lot of tennis balls. But I don't think we're looking so much that they're playing a lot of clay court tennis. Every kid in Spain, like a lot of other countries, can play soccer. I think when it comes down to it becomes very abstract instead of concrete. But there's not, you know, it's not like there's any secrets to it. You know, you've got to hit the ball well, and you've got to have strokes that are going to hold up under pressure.
Right. Well, we're coming down to our last few minutes. I'm wondering if there are any final words of advice or encouragement you'd like to share with parents. I want to, again, remind my listeners to check out your website, www.tennissmith.com. And to sign up for your Great Base Initiative, or to encourage their child's coach to sign up for your Great Base Initiative, to take a look at the Great Base backboard that you offer for sale, and as I mentioned before, it's a portable backboard. It's something you can set up in your garage, in your basement, on your driveway, anywhere, really, in a parking lot, and give your child an opportunity to hit more tennis balls, because the only way to get better is to hit more balls and to hit them with proper technique. But any last words you'd like to share?
Well, I think when it comes down to be a student of the game, you know, I think parents, our website, the Great Base Initiative, it's 1 hour. We have a supplemental course to that that's less than an hour. It's free. It's to become a student of the game. And when it comes down to teaching is information transfer, a feedback system, you know, what did your child learn? What did they work on? If your child comes from practice and they really like practice, it's probably not a good program. If they're giving your child what they want, it's probably not a good program. If your child is complaining about what group they're in, it's probably not a good program. And in other words, I'll hit with anybody. I'm showing up. I'm going to be able to work with younger players, older players. I'm going to be a good citizen. I'm going to come in and I'm going to cooperate. So I think common sense. I think being a student of the game. I think it's great what you're doing with parenting ACEs. I think that you know, the parent needs to be proactive. That doesn't mean they necessarily have to be the coach, but they have to, you know, they don't need to be their child's best friend while their child's growing up. And, I mean, there's winning and losing involved. There's going to be some hardship. There's going to be some heartache. But I think when it comes down to it, can't be a roller coaster. You're going to get out what you put in. But, you know, most young boys and girls, they haven't read one autobiography. They haven't read one story of a great player. But yet a tennis lesson costs 2-3 times what an autobiography would cost. But I think if you're going to be a student, you need to be well-read. You need to study. And it's not a matter of just flipping through Tennis Magazine and watching the Tennis Channel.
Interesting. And now with the Internet, there are interviews online. There are old matches online that players can watch. And again, I know it's two-dimensional, you know, two-dimensional viewing of a three-dimensional game, but it's better than nothing, I would think, right, to watch these?
Well, yeah, when it comes down to YouTube, YouTube's amazing. I always tease people and say, yeah, they've got your 10th birthday party on YouTube. So someone my age, I mean, it's just amazing what's on YouTube. But when it comes down to, like, our first course, Tennis Intelligence Applied, and that's also free, but it's very much like watching paint dry. Someone said it's like drinking out of a fire hydrant. It's 25 hours, but it's all these short clips. But if the parents were to watch that, say, you know, I'm going to do that in the basement. I'm going to do that in the garage. I'm going to go buy a cone, have my son hit some balls, my daughter hit some balls off a cone. They're not going to want to do it. They're going to think they're too advanced for it. Although in basketball, Michael Jordan stands in one spot at the foul line and practices his shot, and that becomes part of the game. Or Derek Jeter's in the on-deck circle practicing his swing. So, you know, tennis kids, they become confused. They don't know their level, so they're really lost. If you don't know where you are at point A, you're not going to get to point B. But our first course, Tennis Intelligence Applied, when it comes down to people like Dennis Vandermeer and Welby Van Horn and Bill Jacobson and Peter Berwash, it's not the Steve Smith method. You know, there's no ego involved. It's a matter of what I've done is I have put a system together, but it's the conglomeration of all these other systems, and I've had a great deal of success, but it's been on the developmental side. You know, I've worked with many, many students who've won, for example, USTA or NCAA national titles, but yet that doesn't really sell tickets because that's not working with someone who's won Wimbledon or the U.S. Open. You know, in my 40 years in tennis, you know, I always tell people I probably only taught a dozen kids who could stuff a basketball. Because I'm a developmental coach, you know, I think we need more first base coaches. I think too many times the people that are working the tournaments and passing out their business card, you know, the merchant of flesh, they're really a third base coach. They want to coach somebody who's already winning. You know, and you go to a small city like, say, Syracuse or Shreveport or a big city like Seattle, is you have coaches fighting over people who can already play. I want to coach that kid. I want to coach that kid. Is that what we need to do is get more people playing, and we need to have more people stay with the game. And you know, then I think that's a matter of, can you, you know, imagine if a parent is told, no, your child should really play soccer, basketball. It'd be great if they start with gymnastics. Why don't they just come out to our program